for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Few issues in the justice system stir passions like the death penalty. Similar to abortion and gun control, the debate over capital punishment polarizes both friends and lawmakers, and there seem to be no simple answers. Joining me from to discuss the issues surrounding the death penalty, from NPR in New York, Robert Blecker of New York Law School. And we hope to have joining us in the studio David Dow of the University of Houston Law Center. He's the author of a new book titled The Autobiography of an Execution. Unfortunately, David Dow seems to have been caught in traffic and is on his way here. We hope he'll join us very shortly. Good morning to you, Robert Blecker. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for having me.
Would you talk about your own work with death penalty cases?
Well, yes. I neither prosecute nor defend condemned killers, but what I have done over the last 25 years is spend a few thousand hours among them in systems in seven states. I've traveled extensively and documented their lives and their hopes and their dreams and their hates. And so I teach criminal law. I think I've gotten to have a sense as to who they are and why they do what they do. And what they deserve.
Was there a particular case that you felt really drew you in?
No, since I've been a child, I grew up believing that Adolf Hitler deserved to die, and the only question for me since has been who else. Now, I do hope David Dow gets here because his book is well worth discussing.
Oh, he's on his way up.
I'm glad because it really is a book that is well worth discussing. So it's not so much a particular case. It's the question of justice. It's the question of who deserves what and why. And for us retributivist advocates of the death penalty, the case is really pretty simple. Some people deserve to die, and we have an obligation to execute them. It really is ultimately that simple. It's about just deserts. It's about moral blameworthiness. It's about certain monsters who are here and what we're to do with them, what we're obliged to do with them if we really seek justice, as the United States Constitution commands that we do, that we seek justice.
So in your view, we really need the death penalty.
Yes, we fundamentally need it. Now, we don't need it for safety's sake. I mean, there are many advocates of the death penalty who propose it and support it because they say it's a more effective deterrent. That is, it more than any other punishment will prevent certain murderers from killing. And that's possible. And then there are studies that go the other way. By and large, it makes common sense that it does act as a more effective deterrent. But for me, that's not ultimately morally relevant. I think that deterrence alone does not justify the death penalty, that we have the capacity to and the obligation to design prison systems so that they are safe and so that they are foolproof and from which inmates cannot escape and in which inmates cannot commit more heinous crimes. That doesn't justify the death penalty for me. It's not according to the future benefit that we derive from it. It's by reason of the past. The past counts, and we make a covenant in part with the dead. Now, I know that sounds irrational to some, and it is non-rational, but it's real and it's right.
David Dow has just joined us. He's the author of a new book titled The Autobiography of an Execution. He is the University Distinguished Professor at the University of Houston Law Center and Director of the Texas Innocence Network. You've heard the voice of Robert Blecker. He's law professor at New York Law School and a supporter of the death penalty. Good morning to you, David Dow. I'm glad you got here.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
Hi, David.
Hi, Robert. How are you?
Good. You?
I'm fine.
Do you believe, David Downs, that we need the death penalty?
Oh, I'm certain that we do not need the death penalty. I think that it doesn't serve any rational purpose. And as I understood what Professor Blecker was saying, he and I don't really disagree on that point. It grows out of an impulse that human beings have to inflict pain on someone who has himself, and it's usually a himself, inflicted pain on other people. And I certainly understand that impulse. I, in fact, talk in the book about how I have that impulse. One of the questions that I'm asked most frequently is whether if someone were to hurt my wife or my son, both of whom I talk a lot about in the book, I would think that person should be executed. And I answer honestly, and I say, I may well think that. I might want to execute that person myself. So I understand the impulse that Professor Blecker is talking about. I simply don't think that the fact that human beings have that impulse means that the state ought to be in the business of carrying out executions.
Do you believe that there is a deterrent effect to carrying out executions?
Oh, absolutely not. Most executions, 75% of the people on death row in the U.S. are there for committing a felony murder. Now, it's a horrible murder. It's a murder that's resulted in the loss of life, and it's caused pain to the person who's killed. It's caused pain to the family members. But most murders grow out of somebody who walks into a convenience store to rob it, and then somebody's murdered. Somebody walks into a bank to rob it. Somebody's murdered. The murders are horrible and inexcusable. And the pain that's associated with those murders, both for the person who's killed as well as the family members, is, I think, as large as the pain that's inflicted when somebody is killed intentionally, when the person wakes up that morning and says, I'm going to go kill somebody. But the mindsets, the approaches to those types of murders are very different. And so they're literally undeterrable because they're not planned. And at the moment that a crime that starts out as a robbery spins out of control, it's literally out of control, and so nobody's thinking about what punishments are available anymore, which is why almost none of my clients could have been deterred because they weren't actually that morning planning on killing anybody.
But in the
Diane, may I respond to that, please?
Hold on 1 second, Bob Blecker. In the example you used, if your wife or your son were to have their lives taken by someone else, you would feel the desire, the need to perhaps carry out retribution on your own part. And, of course, that's what Robert Blecker talks about, is the issue of retribution. Where are you on that?
Absolutely. And, I understand Robert's argument, and I understand the impulse that he's talking about because, as I say, I have the impulse. I think that the difference between Professor Blecker and me is on the point about whether that impulse makes it just for the state to carry out an execution. I would have, frankly, a very different approach to the issue if, for example, the parent of a child who was killed in response to the crime killed the murderer. There was a famous case in Washington State, I believe it was, this is probably already now 10 years ago, where a woman's young child was molested by someone and she killed the molester. Now, I don't justify murder. I wouldn't excuse that conduct, but the questions associated with that conduct are, in my judgment, very different from the questions associated with whether the state ought to kill. So I freely concede and admit that I would have that impulse if anyone were to injure anybody close to me, anyone that I love. But I think that the fact that I have that impulse doesn't translate into saying that it is therefore just or appropriate or right for the state to carry out an execution.
David Downs, he's at the University of Houston Law Center. Bob Blecker, go ahead with your thoughts.
Yes, I'd like to respond to several things. Before I do that, because David just came in, let me say for your listeners that although he and I are on opposite sides of this issue, his book is a book well worth reading. When I began it, I expected the usual abolitionist cant, which I've encountered too many times, and that I would skim it in preparation for today's appearance. And what I found instead was a incredibly engaging read and a most human portrait and really a love story to his son and to his wife, interspersed with the love he bears toward them, the duty that he bears to his clients. Now, having said that, so I do recommend it. I recommend it for those on either side of the debate. I think it's an excellent book. It's really heartfelt and beautifully written. Whether it's fact or fiction is another question. But first, the question of deterrence. When you ask, does the death penalty deter, you're really making it too easy for us and too difficult for him, although he ducked it. Of course the death penalty deters, but so does some people. As the British Commission said, we can number its failures, but we can never number its successes. All we have to do is look in prison and we can number its failures, but we never know how many people who would have otherwise done it didn't. But that's not the issue. The issue is, does the death penalty deter more effectively than its principal alternative, life without parole? And that's a much more difficult case to make. Now, he points to felony murder as the most common crime that's put people on death row, and he's absolutely right. And here we have common ground, and there is significant common ground between David and me in a number of respects, and I hope we get to probe that, although there is a divide between us as well. Felony murder should not be a death-eligible crime. It is a crime that does not have the appropriate attitude of cruelty attaching to it. Now, rape murder should be, but not because rape is a felony, but because rape is itself torture. So he and I are one with that. However, he overstates it slightly when he says that because you didn't intend to kill, you're undeterrable.
All right. We've got to take just a short break. Hold that thought, Robert Blecker, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. As we talk with two people who are very seriously engaged in questions regarding the death penalty, here in the studio is David Dow. He's the author of a brand new book, The Autobiography of an Execution. He is University Distinguished Professor at the University of Houston Law Center and Director of the Texas Innocence Network, and via ISDN from NPR in New York, Robert Blecker. He's law professor at New York Law School, a supporter of the death penalty, and subject of the documentary Robert Blecker Wants Me Dead. We'll take your calls throughout the hour, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I know many of you have very strong feelings about this issue. I want to ask you both, and first you, David Dow. You have witnessed executions. Can you describe that experience for us?
Well, I can try. The witnessing of an execution is traumatic only in the sense that you're watching somebody who you know have poison injected into him and then killed. But it's not a particularly violent act in the sense that we ordinarily use the word violent. We execute people in the U.S. today by injecting them with poison. The electric chair would be a violent act. Firing squad would look violent. But when one witnesses an execution by lethal injection, what one is witnessing is a human being that's strapped down to a gurney and then injected with a drug. The first drug makes him go to sleep. The second drug paralyzes him. The third drug induces cardiac arrest. But by the time of the cardiac arrest, the paralytic agent has already been introduced, and so the body doesn't even flop around the way a human being would flop around ordinarily if there were a heart attack that he was experiencing. So I would say that it's peculiar to observe the end of life in that way, but it's peculiar principally for moral reasons rather than because of the physicality of the act, if that makes any sense.
Of course, we've read about a number of situations where those lethal injections have somehow gone awry.
Yes, that's true. But in most of those cases, the aspect of the procedure that goes awry is invisible to witnesses. In a few states, the witnesses actually see the entirety of the procedure from the moment when the person who's being executed is brought into the room where he's going to be killed all the way through the act itself. In Texas, and so therefore the execution that I've, you know, the executions that I'm familiar with work a little bit differently because the witnesses don't get to see anything until the person has already been strapped down to the gurney and the IVs inserted.
I see.
So all that you really see is somebody having drugs introduced into him.
Bob Blecker, have you?
Yes, well, I also have. I have not witnessed the number of executions David Dow has, but I have witnessed an execution, and his description is accurate as far as it goes, but it seems to me it leaves out, at least for me, something that is very significant. I witnessed the execution of Benny Demps in Florida, and it left me completely dissatisfied because it so nearly resembled what the end of life was like on a hospice, at a hospice where a loved one has poisons injected into him in order to relieve the pain, that it made me shudder. We have lost the distinctive notion of punishment. He came in in all white on a gurney with an IV. I also had the benefit, by the way, of witnessing the dress rehearsal, which in some ways is more revealing than the execution itself, in just the ways that David Dow suggests, because that way you really get to see what's going on. As a witness, you never know where the executioner is, at least in the one that I witnessed in Florida, who is behind a one-way mirror that you don't even realize where he is. But the point is that we've become, to some degree, so ashamed of punishment, and we've severed so nearly the relationship, the fundamental and intimate relationship between punishment and pain, that we are trying to have an antiseptic execution, and one that has severed the connection between the crime and the punishment itself. The condemned makes the last statement. There is next to no or no reference to the victims. If it were done in the way that I would have it done, there would be videotapes showing of the victim's last birthday party, or we would understand why we were putting this helpless person to death. He's quite right. The person is helpless, strapped down, and it's just when I witnessed Benny Demps' eyes just fluttered, and he had a death that almost any of us could envy, in spite of the fact that his victims were locked in the trunk of a car and shot to death mercilessly. So I'm no fan of lethal injection. I think it is a morally wrong turn, and I must also say I'm with him. There's much common ground that I think that the families of the victims should more actively participate, and I'm also with him that I think that the jurors who condemn a person to die should at least have one representative to witness it, as should the judges. Mm. And he makes the point in his book that responsibility has become shunted. No one takes responsibility, and that's it goes way beyond the death penalty. I hope we get to discuss that. It goes to punishment itself. We've designed our system of punishment so that nobody is now taking responsibility for it.
David Dow, tell us about the clients you represented in your book, The Autobiography of an Execution.
Yes, I'd like to. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to do that. And I just wanted to say that I appreciate very much Professor Blecker's nice words about the book. And when talking about the clients, it reminds me of something else that Professor Blecker and I have, I suppose I could say, in common, and that is that neither one of us is a fan of the death penalty system that we actually have. Professor Blecker's support of a death penalty is the support of an idealized version of the death penalty, which is not remotely what we actually have in the U.S. And, of course, my book is about the death penalty system that we actually have. And I talk about a number of cases in the book. There's one central case that I talk about involving somebody who I call Henry Quaker. I don't use his real name. I don't use the real names of anyone for reasons that I explain in an author's note, but I think that everything that I say is factually accurate, even though I've tried to disguise the cases. One of the striking aspects of all of the people that I talk about in the book is that at the moment that they're executed, they're really quite different from the person who they were. So that even when Professor Blecker talks about what his idealized version of a death sentence would look like, I'm not sure that it would really work very well, because there is inevitably a period of time between the time of the crime, which is what elicits all of this primal urge that we have to inflict pain, and the time that we finally get around to executing the person. By the time we finally get around to executing the person, even if you have the speediest legal system that we would be comfortable having, 5, 6, perhaps 7 years have gone by. And so by that time, the person who we're executing is, in a really literal sense, no longer the same person that he was. Now, there are obviously some psychopaths on death row, and I'm not going to dispute that. And in fact, those are the people who really Professor Blecker is most interested in reserving the death sentence for. And I'm not sure that those are people who are going to be transformed the way that almost everybody else on death row is. But most people on death row are profoundly remorseful. I'm not saying all of them are. I'm saying most people on death row are profoundly remorseful, so that by the time we execute them, they're not the same people they once were.
Give me a sense of your fictional but real character, Henry Quaker.
Yes, so he was a man who was convicted of killing his family, his wife and his two children. And there was evidence that a reasonable jury, I think, could have looked at and thought, gosh, maybe this guy did it. But I believe that if he had had a competent trial lawyer, he would never, ever have been convicted. He was convicted because his trial lawyer was really a burnt-out case at the time of the trial, didn't identify any of the holes in any of the evidence. And then at the most important part of a death penalty trial, which is the punishment phase, he didn't put on any case at all. So he literally gave the jury no reason at all to spare Henry Quaker's life. And I talk in the book about how really very few of my clients in the 20 years that I've been doing this have insisted to me that they're innocent. Most of my clients have freely acknowledged their guilt. I've had a couple of clients who have apologized almost immediately after the crime to the family members of the victim and have developed, to the extent one can develop, a relationship with the family members of the victim they have. And by relationship, I just mean that there are open communication lines. Henry Quaker was one of the handful of clients that I've had who said, I didn't commit this crime. I didn't do it. And over time, I came to believe his protestation of innocence. And part of the book is about the difficulty that a death penalty lawyer can have psychologically of coming to grips with the fact that he actually has an innocent client. If I don't believe that my clients are innocent, then when they get executed, I go home that evening and I beat myself up for mistakes that I think that I've made, and I revisit the case and think, what could I have done differently? But then I turn the page and I say, but you know what? He was the one who put himself in that position. Whereas if you believe that your client is innocent, you don't have a page to turn, and the failures are entirely yours.
Robert Blecker, describe your experience with death row inmate Daryl Holton.
Well, there is a strange parallel. Daryl Holton also was convicted of murdering his children, but he did it. We are certain that he did it. He didn't try to cover it up that he did it. All the evidence matches. And he tried to forego his appeals until the very end, fought against his lawyers. He reserved his greatest scorn for his own defense attorneys, not because they were incompetent, but because they stripped him of the autonomy to make the decisions that he wanted to make. He was brilliant. He was wry. He was witty. I used to send him my essays to comment on, and he would nail me at the weak points. I would tell him repeatedly that he needed to die, and he would tell me repeatedly I needed a psychiatrist to find out why it was so important to me that he die. And I was with him. I was the last outside visitor, I believe, before he was executed for the 4 hours. And he revealed himself to be this complex human being that he was. And David makes that point in his book often. We expect to see one-dimensional monsters, and they aren't. Some of them are, but most of them aren't. And the fact that they become different people while in prison than they were when they killed is true, but ultimately, in my view, morally irrelevant. I mean, if we extend this discussion beyond the death penalty to punishment itself, it's well known that the biggest bullies out in the street become the biggest cowards once they're inside the prison without their gun. So you can look at them and say, well, they're a different person than they were in the street. They were predators, they were bullies, and here they're meek and docile and they follow the rules. If you're a retributivist, you connect the past. And Darryl knew he deserved to die, or at least he knew, he believed that once the jury rejected his insanity defense, he deserved to die. And I knew he deserved to die. And he deserved to die not because of who he was then when they killed him. He deserved to die because of what he did and who he was and the attitude with which he did it in
Robert
the past. Robert
Blecker, he's law professor at New York Law School. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have a number of callers. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to West Lafayette, Indiana. Good morning, Ray. You're on the air.
Thank you. I agree with the comments about lethal injection being rather antiseptic. My question is, what would be the impact of televising, if not publicizing, other forms of execution on deterrence? And I'm happy to take my comments off the air.
All right. David Dale.
I think that there would be virtually no effect that would be achieved on deterrence by televising executions. I think that if we televised executions, at least executions as we currently administer them, people might watch once and they would never watch again. A lot of people would probably change the station in the middle of it and go to the Ultimate Fighting or something like that on another station. Because
Robert Blecker.
Well, I mean, I agree with that. Just to follow up on deterrence, I think it should be, I think felony murder should be eliminated as a capital crime, but it can be deterred. I mean, it will deter some people, but so will a life in prison. That's not the issue. That's not the moral issue. I do favor televised executions, as I believe David Dow does, but I would have a firing squad rather than the lethal injection.
Tell me this. Doesn't keeping people in prison for life with no option for parole, how expensive is that? And can states continue to afford this? David Dow.
Well, of course, in Texas, there are a number of district attorneys who do not seek death in some cases because seeking the death penalty is much more expensive than seeking a sentence of life in prison.
How so?
Well, the reason is that a death penalty trial is really two trials. At the first trial, the question for the jury is whether the person committed the crime, which is a factual question. Did he do it or did he not do it? If the jury finds that he did it, then there's a second trial. It's called a phase, but it's really a trial unto itself. And the question at that second trial is, should this person be sentenced to life or sentenced to death? And that's, of course, a moral question. And so the range of facts that are relevant to that moral question is really quite broad. What competent defense lawyers do in order to be prepared at the punishment phase of the trial is they literally go interview every single person who their client has ever known, every family member, every teacher, every doctor, everybody. And so it's really very expensive. And there are a number of district attorneys in Texas who have decided, you know what, the expense is just not worth it. And it's not the expense that comes from the appeals. It's the expense that comes from the trial itself.
What about that, Robert Blecker?
Well, David's right. However, you have to start factoring in how much more expensive it is to keep them alive once geriatric care is necessary. But his distinction between the two phases is correct, and I think it leads to a conclusion as to how to modify the death penalty system. I mean, he points out in his book, and he's absolutely right, that when he's trying to revert, get Quakers' conviction reversed, the standard of evidence is that no reasonable juror could possibly have convicted. And that's the right standard for reversing a conviction, but it's the wrong standard, in my view, for reversing a death penalty. And there, it should be a very different... It's a moral question, as he says, and it is a moral question. And if there's even a lingering doubt as to whether he did it, and even a moral doubt as to whether he deserves it, then, in my view, it should be reversed. So we should apply different standards to the two different phases, and we don't. We tend to apply the same, even though they're two different questions.
Right.
But money is not the issue. If this is the only just response, then even if it's very expensive, we must be committed to it if we're committed to justice. Now, of course, that raises the question of whether this is the only just response.
Robert Plecker, he's law professor at New York Law School. David Dow is at the Houston Law Center and director of the Texas Innocence Network. We'll take a short break. More of your calls when we return. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, creating a 3D world in outer space, we talk with James Cameron about writing and directing Avatar, which is nominated for 9 Academy Awards, including Best Director. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we'll go right back to the phones as we talk with two very, very well-informed people about the death penalty. They each have very different views as well. Let's go to Birmingham, Alabama. Jeannie, you're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. My comment is, I think there are some crimes for which there is no other suitable punishment but the death penalty. For example, Ted Bundy. On the other hand, I think it should be absolutely incontrovertible proof that this person is guilty. And then that way you don't have, you know, overturned death penalties because somebody failed to make use of DNA. And I'll hang up and listen to you on the radio.
Thanks so much for your call, David Dow. Ted Bundy, as an example of someone who murdered a number of people who seemed to exhibit no remorse, did not the victims deserve retribution?
I think the victims might well have deserved retribution. I think it might also be the case that Ted Bundy didn't deserve to live. I think that where I differ from the caller and differ from my friend Robert Blecker, is that I don't think that a statement about whether somebody deserves to live or doesn't deserve to live means that the state should be in the business of executing that person. I think that these are deep moral questions for some people. They're religious or theological questions, and I think that people can disagree about whether somebody like Ted Bundy or Gary Gilmore or Charles Manson deserves to live. I think that what I would also say, though, is that even if I agreed that they don't deserve to live, I would still think that it's not the state that ought to be executing them.
And for you, Robert Blecker, what about the issue of DNA and the number of cases that have turned up in recent years where DNA findings have shown an innocent person executed who was found to be innocent because of DNA?
Well, that's not so, and David doesn't claim it to be so. He knows better. The first of all, DNA is only relevant in about 10% of cases. Secondly, the so-called 130 or so exonerated were not people whom we know to have been innocent who have been executed. Now, his book is a portrayal of someone whom he is convinced and may well have been innocent who was executed. But these DNA exonerations have gotten people off of death row. We do not have a provably innocent person executed in the modern era. Having said that, I acknowledge there probably has been one, and this may be the one that David chronicles in his book. But it seems to me that he has a certain ambiguity, if not ambivalence, about this, about your question about whether people can deserve to die. Because in the book, you look for what it is that he thinks his job is. And at one point, he says, some people call it throwing sand in the gears. I call it doing my job. My goal is to save my clients' lives. And yet 4 pages later, he says, one client committed suicide a week before his execution. That's a victory. Another died of AIDS. Another a victory. And he repeats that. So that it seems as if even if you die earlier, as long as the state doesn't kill you, that's considered a victory. So on the one hand, he says in one place that he's trying to save his client's life, and he quotes his oncologist friend, my goal is to save patients' lives, and barring that, to extend their lives as long as I can. And then he responds by saying, yeah, it's exactly me too. But it's not exactly that. So it's interesting to me that on the one hand, you almost get the concession in his book that some people really do deserve, and in his statement that he just made here on air, that some people really do deserve to die, but he doesn't trust the government to do it. His job?
David Dow.
I don't disagree with a single word that Robert just said. I think that there are some people who, if I were the moral king of the universe, I would say deserve to die. I just don't think that that is an appropriate question for individual human beings to be acting on the basis of. I think we can have philosophical debates about whether somebody has, quote unquote, forfeited his right to live. But I think that that doesn't mean that the state ought to be executing them. So when Robert Blecker says that I count it as a victory when my clients die in some way other than at the hand of the state, that's absolutely right. I do say that.
And consistent with your view.
And it's consistent with my view, absolutely.
All right. Would you also agree with Robert Blecker's statement that no provable innocent person has ever been executed, save the one you discuss in the book?
Oh, I wouldn't even say save the one I discuss in the book. I think that he's right that there has not been somebody who's been executed who has been proved on the basis of DNA evidence to have been innocent of the crime. If DNA is the gold standard, then it's true that there hasn't been anybody executed who has been provably innocent by the gold standard. I think there are quite a number of people who have been executed who the evidence more strongly points in the direction that they were innocent than that they were guilty. But people are going to disagree about those cases.
All right, let's go to Lainey in Salisbury, North Carolina. Good morning. Go right ahead. Lainey, are you there?
Oh, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I certainly can.
Okay, I will try to be brief. I'm age 67 now. In 1964, I was a social worker in the state of Georgia, Georgia being my home. Milledgeville, Georgia, was the state mental hospital. Reidsville, Georgia, was the state high security prison and death row. We went, we being the vice president of the hospital and the head of the high security prison at the mental hospital, and several of his employees, and I all went to Reidsville State State Prison to see if there were persons, prisoners, who, in fact, should be receiving mental health care rather than being locked up in the prison. They would still be in prison, but they would be in prison receiving medical care. On one of the occasions, the last execution that was to occur in the state of Georgia until the 70s, when the Supreme Court decided that it could legally be performed again, that execution was to occur the following day from our trip. We went to...
Leighton, I'm going to have to ask you if you could to really cut short your explanation. Make it as brief as you can.
Okay. The prisoner that was to be executed the next day, his family and preacher were there. The head of the hospital and the head of our high security at the hospital said, come on, and they were talking loudly, come on and come see. It was like a show. Come on and come see. Here's the man that's to be executed in the morning. They're already on death watch. He's speaking loudly while the family is hearing all of this. They then invited me to sit in the electric chair. Three men stood behind a curtain. All three would pull their the electric arm in unison. Only one of those was attached to the chair. None of them knew which one it was, in order to at least give them some security that they might not have been the one that killed him.
All right, Lainey, thank you for your call. David Dow, I'm sure you have some reactions.
Well, I was intrigued by the aspect of Lainey's story that focused on the relationship between mental illness and the population on death row. I think that it's an unfortunate fact that a high percentage of death row inmates are mentally ill, and they end up on death row because that mental illness is never addressed.
David Dow, he's author of The Autobiography of an Execution. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Fairfax, Virginia. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Diane. Quick question or quick comment. One is, if the both of the gentlemen could comment on the death penalty case where in the state of Virginia, the state Supreme Court refused to analyze DNA after the fact to see if the person that had, I believe, been executed was truly the perpetrator. And also, if the gentleman could also comment on the equality of representation for the person on trial in reference to people who have more assets to have a fair representation for defense versus also the assets that the prosecutor's office has versus the public defender's office.
All right. Thanks for your call, Bob Blecker.
Well, I don't know the case he's talking about in Virginia, so I can't discuss that. In terms of the equality of representation, I mean, if you're lucky enough to have David Dow in Texas or anyone from his office, if you've read his book, you can count your lucky stars. The appellate representation, at least in many states, is as good as it gets. There are lawyers who are assuaging their conscience for getting their $1,000 an hour from their corporate clients by devoting themselves to death penalty cases. That's not always true at the trial level, of course, and he chronicles with Henry Quaker one sad story where it's not true. In terms of the outspending, that's also, to some degree, a myth. I can't comment about Texas, and he certainly can, and I would defer to his expertise. But in, for example, Oregon, the defense routinely outspends the prosecution something like 3-1, 4-1, even 10-1 on death penalty cases. They have much more resources available to them. So the people who really get hurt are not the wealthy, and they're not the very poor. They're the lower middle class who don't get the public lawyers and can barely afford the relatively poor counsel that they do get.
David Dowd, do you know about this Virginia case he's referring to?
I think that he's actually referring to the Roger Coleman case. And the Roger Coleman case is a case where a man by the name of Roger Coleman had said for many years that he was innocent. And it's true that the Virginia Supreme Court did not permit posthumous DNA testing, but it was in fact eventually permitted by the governor of Virginia. I don't remember who was the governor at the time, and the DNA testing, in fact, revealed that Coleman was guilty of the crime, not that he was innocent of the crime. I think that might be the case that he's talking about.
All right. And let's, just for the few moments we have left, Robert Blecker, what do you think the death penalty does to us as a society?
I think it commands our attention and humane perspective and demands that we make discriminations that we are obliged to make between the very worst of the worst of the worst and everybody else. I think it focuses us in a way that life in prison does not upon those who might be wrongly convicted. I think it focuses us upon who really deserves to die and why in ways that life in prison does not focus on who really deserves a life in prison. So I think it really is a fulcrum for our own moral code. And I think it shows, yes, David is right. For me, it's not an idealized, but yes, I am no fan of the death penalty as is. But we have an obligation, I think, to improve it, not to end it, but to improve it.
David, what do you think the death penalty does to us?
I think that it reveals that we are both cowards and hypocrites. It reveals that we're cowards because nobody takes responsibility for the death penalty system that we actually have. And I think that that's a point that Robert Blecker and I agree on. The point that we disagree on is the second one. I think that it also reveals that we're hypocrites when it comes to the criminal justice system. We have a moral rule, and the moral rule is that killing is wrong. And there are exceptions to that, to be sure. The reason we fight wars is because some wars are an exception to that. But I don't think that there is a persuasive reason, either a moral reason or a factual reason, as to why we should make an exception to this general rule when it comes to carrying out ordinary executions.
What about the work of terrorists? What about those who try to kill thousands of people at one given time?
Yes, isn't it perverse that we would punish somebody who has tried to kill himself in a failed suicide bombing attempt by killing that person? I just think that that's perverse. I'm all in favor of keeping society safe, and I'm all in favor of inflicting a severe punishment. I think that if one is able to arrest a suicide bomber before he manages to kill, or even after, that the appropriate punishment is to keep that person in prison for the rest of his life and to make an example to others around the world that we are going to make our society safe by taking you bad people, you terrorists, out of society and putting you in an environment that you would actually find worse than death itself.
Robert Blecker, what do you think?
Well, that's simply, I mean, that you talk about an idealized system. This is David Dow's idealized system. Having traveled to maximum security prisons, more than 12 of them in 7 states, I can tell you that that's not what life is like inside the ones that I've seen. They watch color TV. They play ping pong. They play volleyball. They play softball. There's even an arts and crafts room on Tennessee's death row. There's a rodeo in Oklahoma, etc. Their life is not a living death. It is not deserved. They get better medical care. And it's ironic that for some people, their lives inside are better than their lives outside. David Dowd presents it as being in a cage, and yet he quotes Green, one of his characters, by saying, "It's my home." And that's what they call it. They call it their home. Life takes on a new normal. This is not an adequate punishment. Sometimes only death is the only just punishment.
Last word, David Dowd.
I don't think that Robert Blecker's ever been to Texas. Life on death row in Texas is life 23 hours a day in a 60-square-foot cell all by yourself. You don't have television. You have a radio that gets two stations for 1 hour a day. If you're on good behavior, they move you from your small cage to a larger cage so that you can exercise. I don't know anybody, no matter what circumstances he or she grew up in, who would want a life like that.
David Dow, he's the author of The Autobiography of an Execution. Robert Blecker is law professor at New York Law School. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.